This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Even among those who live in the Great Lakes State, there's a fair amount of confusion about the health of the Great Lakes. I've had a lot of people tell me the lakes have never been clearer, not realizing that especially clear water was the result of an invasive species devouring the base of the lake's food chain. Well, there's a new book which chronicles the Great Lakes' history and threats. It's an easy-to-read book, but it will shock a lot of people unfamiliar with the, quote, ecological unraveling of the lakes. The title is The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. The author is Dan Egan, and he joins us now. Dan, the Great Lakes used to be more or less an isolated ecosystem, but with the opening of human-made canals and the St. Lawrence Seaway, the Great Lakes have changed dramatically in a very short time. What has caused those changes?
Well, yeah, you're correct. I mean, despite their vastness, they span collectively some 94,000 square miles, but they were, until relatively recently, as isolated as a pond up in the North Woods. And that changed with the construction of the canals that linked the lakes to the Atlantic Ocean. And by those canals, I mean, first there was the Erie Canal, and then the Canadians built the Welland Canal. And that process culminated with the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway in 1959, which allowed for the first time some really big boats to come into the lakes from all over the world. The problem is that these boats didn't just bring the cargoes that were listed on their manifests. They brought a lot of unwanted cargo. And by that, I mean specifically invasive species. And these are organisms that really hitchhike their way into the lakes and overseas freighters' ballast tanks. And ballast tanks are used to stabilize boats on the open water. But the problem is that weight that ballast water isn't dead weight. It's anything but. And because of this contaminated ballast, we've gotten dozens of unwanted organisms in the lakes that have really unraveled the natural balance that had been, you know, the rule of the lakes for thousands of years.
I want to talk a little further about that, but let me ask you about an invasive species that wasn't carried by ballast, but because of these open canals. Tell me about sea lampreys.
Yeah, you know, the sea lampreys were really the first invader that showed the region, you know, the damage of this, many people call it biological pollution. And unlike a lot of the invasive species that we're worried about today, like zebra and quagga mussels and round gobies, lampreys made their way into the lakes, you could argue, honestly, because they swam up. They weren't carried by boats. They swam up the canals from the East Coast. They're technically a fish. They look more like an eel, and they make their living by attaching themselves to large fish and literally sucking the life out of them. The first lampreys were discovered above Niagara Falls sometime, I'm going from memory here, but I think it was in the 1920s, and it did not take them long to totally devastate the Great Lakes' premier predator, which was the lake trout. And the lake trout was kind of like the wolf in the system. They controlled the flow of energy. They kept all the smaller species in check. And when the lampreys took them out, that opened the door for smaller fish to explode. And unfortunately, behind the lampreys came alewives, another invader from the Atlantic seaboard. And both of these species they're called anadromous. So they spend part of their life in freshwater and their adult lives in saltwater before returning to their freshwater tributaries to spawn. But if they have suitable habitat, they don't need that saltwater component of their life. And they found that suitable habitat here in the Great Lakes. So when the alewives arrived after the lake trout had been taken out, they just exploded. And I'm sure some of your listeners we'll remember the dark days of the alewife die-offs back in the mid-1960s when beaches were really unusable.
Yeah, they were just piled up on the beaches, dead alewives.
Yeah, just rotting flesh.
So we had these crashes and rises of the alewife population, but they were still there and they were still causing a lot of problem. And the answer to the alewife problem ended up being the introduction of non-native fish, coho and Chinook salmon, which preyed on the alewife. That's what made the Great Lakes a big sport fishing thing. How did that come about?
It's a really interesting story. So yeah, we had this lamprey infestation, and then we had this alewife explosion. And the first step to solving the problem was to somehow control the lampreys. And that was done with the discovery of a specific chemical called lampricide, which is, you know, it really does specifically target lampreys. They're a devastatingly good parasite, but they're also a very old one. There's fossils that are like 370 million years old of lampreys that they found. So they've been very successful for hundreds of millions of years, but this left them with a a rather primitive liver, which made them uniquely vulnerable to certain types of poisons. So they poisoned the streams and tributaries in which the lampreys were spawning, and that knocked down their numbers to just a sliver of what they had been. And that opened the door for the restoration of a top predator in the lakes. And somebody could argue that the natural answer would have been lake trout, remnant populations of which were hanging on up in Lake Superior and in other areas of the Great Lakes. But the state of Michigan decided to go in another direction. They saw these alewives as a potential boon for a salmon fishery. So the state acted largely unilaterally back in the mid and late 1960s to bring in Pacific coho and Chinook salmon, and they planted them in the lakes, and they didn't know what exactly was going to happen. Some people thought that the salmon would just have a nose for the ocean and swim down the St. Lawrence Seaway and be gone. But as it turned out, these biologists were dead on in their assessment that the alewives would be a perfect meal for these Pacific predators. So it's really kind of a strange situation if you think about this. You've got an Atlantic invader being feasted upon by a Pacific predator in the middle of the continent in a place that isn't an ocean. And it was a program that worked magnificently to create what is today a multi-billion dollar sport fishery.
And the ironic thing is three generations have grown up fishing for salmon, and now the salmon is starting to disappear in places. It's nearly gone in Lake Huron. Lake Michigan might be next to lose its salmon fisheries. Why is that happening?
Okay, so it was weird. The story that we were just talking about essentially is the top of the food chain, you know, being taken out. And what's happening today is in many ways more problematic because it's the bottom of the food chain that's being taken out because of the invasion of zebra and quagga mussels, which have literally decimated plankton populations out in the lake. And that plankton is what really sustains everything in the lake. You take that out and everything above it suffers all the way up to the salmon. And so on Lake Huron, the salmon fishery is just about gone because the alewives are gone. And on Lake Michigan, alewife populations are struggling and looks like we could be headed in the same direction as far as the salmon fishery goes. But what's interesting about this is the invasions, you know, they've just kept coming. So behind these mussels came another fish, came from the same place, the Caspian Sea Basin. It came the same way as a hitchhiker aboard an overseas freighter. And it's called the round goby, and it is nature built to eat these mussels. And so this little bug-eyed fish, you know, not much bigger than your thumb, is going to town on the mussels. And what they're really doing is unlocking all that energy, all that protein tied up in these mussel shells that was previously unavailable to anything in the lake. So fish that can eat gobies are actually doing pretty well. And as it turns out, salmon can't really make a living off gobies because they're built to chase schooling fish such as alewife. And our native species, walleye, whitefish, are learning to make a living off the gobies. And what's really interesting is whitefish aren't piscivores. They're not fish-eating fish. But if it's a goby or death, they'll take the goby. And so, you know, I've heard some people explaining it as like evolution on the fly. I mean, these fishermen are seeing whitefish coming in with their jaws ripped open because they're not built to put their mouth around a fish. They're built to grub a living off the bottom of the lake, but now they're eating gobies, and now they're starting to show signs of recovery. So over on Lake Huron, the top of the food chain is looking more like its old or natural self today than it has in decades or maybe even more.
There's a lot of concern about the Asian carp. It's the poster child of invasive species. They're afraid it's going to get into the Great Lakes, and may have already done that through a canal at Chicago that connects the Mississippi River system with the Great Lakes. But fewer people are aware of the many, many invasive species, including the quagga mussels you just mentioned. Last I saw, it was something like 170 different species, mostly from Eastern Europe, that had been introduced into the lakes because of hitchhiking and ballast water. Is that right?
No, that isn't actually correct. There are some 186, 187, it's a running number, non-native species in the lakes. And that's an important distinction between invasive and non-native. And obvious question would be, what's the definition? And it is a fuzzy definition. An invasive species is something that's basically something that humans don't like, something that's causing problems, at least from our perspective. And so while we have some 186, 187 non-native species, some of the most devastating of those species, some of the most invasive of those species have indeed come up via ballast water on ships sailing up the St. Lawrence Seaway. And that number is, I believe, somewhere around 59 or 60. So the Seaway only opened in 1959. So it's been over history, like almost one a year. And that rate has slowed significantly in the last decade since the ships coming into the lakes have agreed to start flushing their ballast tanks with mid-ocean salt water. And that's gone a long way to solve the problem, but it hasn't solved the problem. In fact, in the last 6 months, it's been announced that two new non-native species, we don't know yet if they're going to be invaders or considered invasive, have been discovered in the western basin of Lake Erie. Everybody knows that this saltwater flushing of ballast tanks is a great first step, but it's not a final step. And the shipping industry is under order to begin installing ballast water treatment systems to better sterilize. And sterilize isn't actually a good word because we can't sterilize a hospital room, let alone these ballast tanks that can hold millions of gallons of water, but to better disinfect their discharges. And the problem is the shipping industry says it's expensive and the technology is evolving and they're working as fast as they can. But in the meantime, the door remains open to who knows what. I mean, nobody heard of a zebra mussel until they became a big problem.
Let's look at the western end of Lake Erie. There, people are really concerned about algal blooms. They lead to toxins in the water, cyanobacteria, which actually caused the Toledo, Ohio water supply to shut down at one point. What's causing those algal blooms?
It's kind of a confluence of a few things, but I guess we'll go back to invasive species to start. Zebra and quagga mussels have invaded significantly or severely Lake Erie. And, you know, these things suck plankton, suck anything floating out of the water, and they'll eat just about anything. They don't have brains, but they're smart enough not to eat a certain type of cyanobacteria called microcystis. You can see it in YouTube videos where in an aquarium, a mussel will be sucking all these flecks out of the water, and for some reason it spits one back. Well, that one is this form of toxic algae. And so over years, they've selected for this particular algae. So when you have an algae outbreak, it's much more likely to be this toxic stuff than a whole assemblage of different types of organisms that would have been the case back in the 1960s. So you've got that. You've got the mussel factor. Then you've got bigger rains happening in the spring, and that's an unfortunate time for a big pulse of water to come off the land into western Lake Erie because that's a time when there's a lot of fertilizer out in the crops before the crops have begun to take up the fertilizer, specifically phosphorus. So it's a combination of too much phosphorus going into the lake at the wrong time. And at the wrong time is probably because, you know, the climate is changing and we're getting big spring storms more than we have historically. And then when these algal blooms take place, they're likely to be toxic. And that's how Toledo lost its water for a couple of days a few years back.
So if we know this is part of the problem or part of the one factor of this problem is fertilizer pollution. Why isn't more being done to stop it? I mean, after all, this year there's a substantial algal bloom that could threaten Toledo's water yet.
That's a great question, and I'm not the person that can answer it. But, you know, we had big algae problems in Lake Erie back in the 1960s, and scientists got together and they figured out that it was an overdose of phosphorus that was causing this. And so they basically put the lake on a phosphorus diet, and it was a miraculous recovery that happened real quickly. I mean, by 1985, these blooms had pretty much disappeared. Well, today they're back. And the reason they're back is because the phosphorus going into the lake, it's by volume, by weight, it's no more than what it has been. It's coming off these farm fields in a highly reactive, highly potent form, dissolved reactive phosphorus. And it is just like, you know, gasoline as far as its ability to fuel these algal outbreaks. And like the 1960s, the scientists, the scientific community has gotten together and they've developed a new diet and they believe they can get this problem under control. But so far, unlike back in the 1960s and 70s, when we mustered the political will to do it, so far we have not. Any kind of restrictions are purely voluntary at this point.
To me, the bottom line of your book seems to be there are things threatening the Great Lakes. We know what they are. But we're not doing all that we can to fix the problems. So where does that leave us?
It leaves us right now with this sense that we're kind of going backwards, which is a real shame. I mean, we've come a long way since, you know, June of 1969 when the Cuyahoga River last burst into flames. And, you know, there was something that fire, that river had burned a lot in the decades prior, and so had rivers all across the Great Lakes Basin and the country, for that matter. There's something about that fire that made people say enough's enough. And out of that fire, we got the Clean Water Act, and we got, you know, dramatic water quality improvement. I don't know what it's going to take today for people to say enough is enough, but we've got, you know, some of these old problems coming back, and the door to new invasions remains open as long as the ballast problem's there. And I like to consider that door the front door, the St. Lawrence Seaway. And then we have the back door, the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, which is an artificial connection between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River Basin, which spans like 40% of the continental United States. So that canal isn't just a pathway for carp to potentially make their way into the lakes. It's also a pathway for things to make their way out of the lakes. And that's why out west, they're now just beginning to deal with their own quagga mussel infestation.
Here's the thing. So we have the reason we keep the canal in Illinois at Chicago open is so barge traffic can transfer freight from larger vehicles. We have the ocean-going vessels coming in because of trade. But what I'm wondering is, have the economies of the cities, states, and provinces profited more from international shipping than they've lost in damage to the lakes?
You're not the only person who's asked that question. In 2005, a couple of logistics experts from over in Michigan, had worked for, I believe it was the Department of Transportation, and one at the time was at Grand Valley State University. They looked at economic savings tied to bringing in cargo on overseas ships into the Great Lakes. And what a lot of people don't realize is that Great Lakes shipping is a big, important business, but the overseas component of it is relatively tiny. Fewer than two ships a day sail up the St. Lawrence Seaway, two overseas ships a day into the Great Lakes. And so these guys looked at what they were carrying, and it's primarily steel coming in and grain going out. And they looked at other means to bring that cargo into the region, whether it was by truck, train, Mississippi River barge. And the number they came up with was it was saving the region about $55 million annually. Now, that was at a time when about 12 million tons of overseas cargo was moving on the lakes. And in some recent years, it's been as low as 5 or 7 million tons. So in that respect, the economic benefit doesn't look huge. On the other side of the ledger, you've got, you know, the mussels that have done so much damage in so many different ways. I mean, the way you can start seeing it on a budget is what the power companies and utilities are paying in this annual chronic fight to keep their pipes clear of the clustering mussels. But then you also have to look at what they've done to the fisheries. And on Lake Huron, the salmon are all but gone. It's a fuzzy number to try to put a fine point on, but it's easily hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, that have been done and damaged just from this one species. So, you know, I don't advocate in the book to shut the ships out of the Great Lakes, but I do give voice to people who say, let's put that on the table. Let's weigh the cost and benefits. And if we can't solve this ballast water problem with technology, maybe we solve it with policy.
Dan Egan covers Great Lakes environmental issues at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's the author of the book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. It's the winner of the J. Anthony Lucas Award. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Stateside for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.